Hey, this is John Lee Dumas of the award-winning podcast, Entrepreneurs on Fire, and you're listening to the Excelsior Journeys with George Soroy. Prepare to ignite.
So would you say that that's kind of like the lightning bolt moment for
you? And that's
why
I taught myself how to draw, was actually the Little Mermaid, drawing stills of Ariel.
I've got better things to do tonight than die.
Sylvester jumped out of his chair and said, who the F is this?
I remember walking out of the theater with him saying, I'm going to write Halloween.
I'm rather impressed with your research. Rarely do people ask me about Children in the Corn.
It doesn't have to be perfect. Just do it. You know, throw some spaghetti against a wall. See if it sticks.
This is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward. Welcome back to Excelsior Journeys, the road to creativity. This is George Soroy. Thank you so much for being here and welcome back to this show. It is the season 11 premiere. And for over 300 episodes, for nearly 7 years now, if I can do the math right, yes, nearly 7 years, this show has been a wonderful haven for writers, screenwriters, filmmakers, producers, artists, stand-up comics, for voiceover artists, for musicians, from toy designers, and just so much that is going on right now. Everyone is steeped into that wonderful world of storytelling. And I can't think of a better person to start off season 11 than with my guest this week. Alan Katz has been a force in so many different franchises that you know and love. The Outer Limits, Nightmare on Elm Street, Tales from the Crypt, and Children of the Corn, so much that he has done. And then he has forged his way into this wonderful world of podcasting. He has several shows available to download and enjoy. The man has been just a constant force of storytelling in all different formats, as a writer, as a producer, as a story editor, as a podcaster, whatever the means of getting those stories out there. He is the perfect person to start this season 11 of Excelsior Journeys, The Road to Creativity. It is my pleasure to introduce my guest, Alan Katz. Alan, how are you, sir?
I'm very good, George. Thank you so much for the kind words. Now all I could do is underwhelm.
This would not be an Excelsior Journeys episode if I did not throw a tip of the hat to Podmatch for bringing us together.
Indeed,
Alex, once
indeed.
Again, you have done a world of good by linking so many different podcasts and guests. I know he's not paying me to say that. You know, like I'm saying that from the bottom of my heart. I am so happy to have signed up for this service. It's been 5 years now.
Not only are you not paying for it, you're paying him for it.
I was grandfathered in, so I stuck at the ground floor.
I'm paying for it, but I don't mind that subscription, because that subscription keeps me in contact with a remarkable community of people, podcasters, all of them, including and especially yourself, George.
So, and hey, it's an ROI.
Alex, talk to us. Give us a ring. You could be advertising on both our podcasts. And that's how podcasting works.
Right. We all help each other out. We may be solo shows. We may be part of a network, but we are all a community. We're all a community of podcasters who love doing this format. I have had nothing but a great time doing it. Did I need to take a hiatus? Of course. But it was more vacation than anything. I just needed to breathe for a little bit.
Oh,
who knew?
The demands of podcasting, it is in a lot of ways a performance art, because the persona that we are in front of the microphone, it is us, but it cannot be a literal us. It is a presentation of us as honestly as we can possibly portray ourselves. The goal is to be as honest as we can in front of the microphone, but it's still a performed version of us, because we're aware of the fact that we're doing it hopefully to a room full of people. So there must be something performative about it, or you're just not going to come across.
It's something about being in front of this microphone that really grabs my attention.
I've hired lots and lots of actors across the course of my career. But I can tell you this, I never hired a single one of them wanting them to act. It was the last thing I wanted any actor I hired to do.
Yeah.
When they're on the stage in a theater, the people in the last row have to see and hear them, so they must act. The camera is right there in their face. If they act, that's what the camera will see. What I want an actor to do for the camera, I'll give them give them a different name, some put some words in their mouth, but at key moments, they need to be tapped. They need to tap into their naked, raw emotions with absolute fidelity. If there's any artifice, the camera will see it. We'll have to cut it out. Mm-hmm. But what makes for truly great acting and screen performances is the seeming nakedness of the emotions, the realness. Yeah. And that's what makes for great film performances. Well, the microphone works exactly the same way.
Yes.
And it's all artifice. And so what's great about podcasting is that literally anyone can do it. It's very democratic that way. Mm-hmm. What separates everybody from, you know, the better podcasters is that better podcasters begin to realize that the microphone is not a piece of equipment. It's an extension of their vocal cords. I think of it often as being like a lover's ear, simply that I would never shout into it or shout at it. I respect it. And sometimes, yes, you might need to whisper ever so gently into it. And you can convey the entire range of human emotions through your voice, so long as you think of it as an extension of yourself.
Yes. And that came through so well in the audio drama that I did, which I wouldn't have even thought could actually happen if I didn't go forward into this wonderful world of podcasting. And then all of a sudden discovering that there was a chance for me to turn one of my books into an audio drama. And exactly what you were saying before, every performer that I worked with on that show, we were doing this live in the Clubhouse app. And there were people from all around the world. We had people in California. We had people in the UK. We had people in Australia. And they were all like all there at the same time. And they were all telling a story and wonderfully performing the story. And everything was real. Everything was there. And some of the greatest moments of my life came from that. This was the first time that I got to experience my own words being performed by someone else. A character that had been with me for over 30 years, all of a sudden he's got a different voice now.
Now, as someone who's also enjoyed that experience on multiple occasions, oh, yeah. I remember my first time. I do recall. What was that first time like for you?
I've heard other people perform some stuff that I've written before, you know, the short film that I did back in college. But this felt like 100% mine. And it felt wonderful. It felt absolutely wonderful. It felt gratifying that there were so many great people involved. It felt validating because people were listening at the moment and flooding the chat window so much that I had to turn it off because it was freezing up my laptop. But I got to go back and look at all those comments, and they were so touching. They were all talking about how great the actors were, how great the story was, how much fun this sounded. And it just blew my mind. And that would not have happened if I didn't get into this venture of podcasting in general, just wanting to be a storyteller in any way possible.
Having done Tales from the Crypt and feature films and TV series, the separation from the audience is profound. From the time that I write and the time it actually hits the air, I have literally had no connection to the audience whatsoever. Mm. There is this odd disconnect. The other thing that's weird about that world, it's really weird, to take an idea from my head and turn it into, oh, let's say a TV series.
Yeah.
To write the script, if you're lucky, on average, it's about 10 years. It takes an awful lot of people to get it right, to get it ready for the marketplace. Now you're ready for the marketplace. It's a TV series. So you wrote the first script. You wrote season one, episode one. What happens S1E2? And third episode, the fourth episode, hey, what happens the whole first season? And then what happens season two, season three? What are the larger story arcs? And who are all these characters? And how do they all fit into this? What's the tone of all this? You got to write that. It's called a Bible. And that doesn't happen overnight. That takes really another year to write. Now you're invested a couple of years here. Now you're ready for the marketplace. You got to get this to the executives at a handful of places who have the coin to pay for what it is that you want to do. In order to induce them to read it, you're going to have to create a pitch deck. A pitch deck is like a PowerPoint presentation. It's the comic book version. It's a couple of words, lots of images, just to get these motherfuckers to read your material. Okay, let's say one of these motherfuckers says, yeah, okay, I'll read it.
Yeah.
It
doesn't mean anything.
That doesn't mean anything, because even if they say yes, now you're going to go through a whole meat grinder. No idea what kind of sausage is going to come out the other end. And at any point, there are thousands of assholes who can kill your project dead for no other reason than they're a fucking asshole. Now, the same idea. I want to turn it into a podcast. There's only one asshole standing in my way, and it's me. And so long as I'm willing to do the work, probably gratis up front, but so long as I'm willing to do it, and then, all right, I'm going to have to find my own audience or help the audience find this content that I'm going to create. I can one-man band this. I can do the whole thing soup to nuts. I can create a piece of content. There is nobody standing in my way except me. And if I've got creative partners in it, everyone has to continue to feel validated, seen, heard, understood. Mm-hmm. If it's their story that I'm telling or helping them tell, I've got to make sure that they always feel connected in every way, shape, and form to what we're doing. But at the end of the day, we can create this content and put it out into the world, and nobody can stop us or tell us what to do or how to do it, other than what is important to the content itself and its relationship to the audience. Hey, I want to do content that's going to go on hours and hours. The audience will tell me very quickly when they don't show up, when they stop watching about 10 seconds in, dude, you're boring. They will tell me, the marketplace will tell me how boring I am. They will. It's really democratic that way.
Yeah.
And so I must be responsive to my audience in order to have an audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You got to know what's working, what's not. And the only way that you know that is by people saying this works, this doesn't.
Exactly so. But there's no executive with who knows what their political motives are. I don't mean politics, but even within the...
Well, politics are everywhere.
Company, it's madness. All right. So podcasting as a creative medium, really, we've, in a very Tales from the Crypt kind of a way, we've done the penultimate panel. Now, how did I end up in the medium that I think is the most satisfying, gratifying, wonderful creative medium of all?
Where did all this start? That's one of the things I love to hear about, is that road to creativity. It's just like once you experience something or hear something, see something.
I have been a professional writer. I've been paid to write since I was 16. 16 was the first time I ever got paid to write anything. And so I've always taken writing for granted. I was a drama major in high school.
Me too.
I went to Vassar.
Oh, very nice.
Outside of New York.
Yeah, I grew up in Poughkeepsie.
Oh,
I grew up in Poughkeepsie.
Oh, my madness.
We moved there when I was right before I was 3. We left right before I was 12.
Your dad worked for IBM or something?
No, he worked for RCA.
Oh, okay.
RCA and then Whirlpool. One of my best friends growing up, his dad worked for IBM. So there you go.
In Wappingers Falls, there was a huge IBM facility, gigantic.
Yeah. Well,
anyway, I was a drama major at Vassar. When I graduated, I went to one audition, and I was terrible and not well prepared. I walked out and I said, fuck this. What kind of an idiot makes a living like this? I'm going to go be a writer instead. I decided I would not act again until someone asked me nicely, which did happen. Mick Garris asked me very nicely to be in an episode of Tales from the Crypt.
That's great.
Yeah, he did. And I said, yes. But I had a friend who I went to school with named Carol Yumpkus, who had become an agent at William Morris in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
And Carol said, hey, you should try writing a screenplay. And so I wrote one. And she said, this is pretty good. You should come out and meet and greet people. And so in June of 1985, I flew from New York to Los Angeles for a week of meet and greet. Now, I was a burgeoning New Yorker in the theater. To me, Los Angeles was the stupidest place on the planet. Mm-hmm. The land of the avocado head. Just fucking stupid. I got there And June on the East Coast, it's hot, it's humid. Mm-hmm. In New York, in Manhattan back then, every place smelled like piss walking around. But
around that time, yeah, with time over Times Square, yeah.
But in June in LA, you know, it's the desert. There's no humidity here. The sun, the weather was fantastic. 40 years ago, it was a lot less crowded than it is now. And the people were so nice to me. One evening, Carol took me to a movie premiere, St. Elmo's Fire. William Morris represented it. My view of this was entirely from the inside, and it was intoxicating, to say the least. At the party afterwards, someone said, you should take a drive through Topanga Canyon. I had no appointments the next morning. So I did. And 40 years ago, it was a lot less busy than it is now, but it's this kind of wild, rustic, within the city limits canyon. And as I drove from the freeway, the 101, through the Santa Monica Mountains, as they plunge into the water at the Pacific Coast Highway, by the time I got to the water, I was completely New York. Fuck New York, man. LA is my lady. I'd been completely seduced by the place.
Wow.
Now, among the very first people that I met that first week in Los Angeles was Gil Adler.
No kidding.
And so you've interviewed Gil.
Yes, I have.
And so I met Gil. He's one of the first people I met. We very quickly became best friends and creative partners for a decade. Wow. Now, Gil, it's funny, I'm not a horror guy. I went to LA thinking I'm a comedy guy, because I was a comedy guy. Gil came out of the theater in New York, but mostly comedy. Gil trained as an accountant. Gil understood as a producer that if you have a dollar to make your TV show, don't spend a dollar one, you haven't got it. If you can make your TV show for 99 cents or 98 cents and still make it look like that dollar, that's really good. Better yet, if for 97 cents you can make it look like a dollar one or a dollar two, now you're onto something. Gil's creative process is constant problem solving. And so Gil's solution to solving the problems wasn't throw more money at it. It was throw more creativity at it, which was exactly my approach.
Yeah, because that's always the best thing, is those limitations that force the creativity out.
Yes, 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 yes. So we suddenly bonded because we both had the same approach to the creative problem solving process. Gil had produced a show for HBO called The Hitchhiker. Up in Vancouver. HBO knew that he was a responsible producer. They had a problematic show that it was very expensive, over budget, way over schedule. It was called Vietnam War Stories. It was shooting in Savannah, Georgia. They sent Gil to take it over and help it along. He not only turned the ship around, it ended up winning awards.
Mm.
A little while later, HBO had another big ticket production with a huge problem. They wanted Gil to take it over. That was called Tales from the Crypt.
Mm.
Now, when Tales from the Crypt came into being in the early 1990s, HBO was just dipping its toe into the original content business. They had a show called
First and Ten. I loved First and Ten growing up.
These were basically just single camera shows with hits and the word fuck. If you took tits and fuck out, it was basically just a network-ready single-camera show in every other way, shape, and form. Suddenly, you had these four big Hollywood mega-producers, Joel Silver, Richard Donner, Walter Hill, Bob Zemeckis, approached HBO with a passion project, a comic book series that they loved from their boyhoods, DC Comics, the horror series. They wanted to bring this comic book that they loved, and they wanted to put it, well, as I said to HBO, we want to take this passion project and take a feature film vision in your TV box. And HBO jumped up and down and said, yes, 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 we love it. Do whatever the fuck you want.
Yes.
And so normally you would say, HBO would have said, yes, let's put it into development and see how we're doing this.
Yeah.
There was no development process. So no one ever asked the question, okay, how exactly do we translate all those franchise elements that we love in the comic books to this different medium so that every frame of every episode looks like it's supposed to look? It doesn't happen by magic, someone or some people have to oversee this process, a story editor, something, anything.
Right.
No such person was ever hired. The first three episodes are brilliant. Joel, Bob Z's all
house was great.
Walters, the man who was death, and Dick Donner's Dig This Cat, He's Real Gone are brilliant. Yeah. HBO ordered a back three, which are a lot less brilliant. And then they ordered a second season of 18 episodes with a third season of 13 episodes. Still no development process. Also no deficit partner. The way the TV shows work, whatever the network, HBO or NBC, whatever they pay the license fee each time they show it, they pay a license fee. The first license fee, even the second time, the third time, it's never going to pay for the cost of production. It's not until it gets to some kind of syndication aftermarket sale that somehow it's going to have the potential of profitability. And so the person who's going to cover the risk is your deficit partner. Mm. Well, the partners never got a deficit partner. They were feature guys. They never got a deficit partner. So HBO cash flowed that whole second season. And the night before the wrap party, HBO handed the executive producers a financial statement that said, guys, you're $1 million cash in the hole. If you want that third season, and there was lots of money for the executive producers in that third season, the executive producers promptly canceled the wrap party. They fired everybody. They got out their checkbooks and they paid HBO. So there's going to be a third season, and HBO wanted a producer who they trusted. And so they wanted Gil.
Yeah.
And so since I was Gil's writing partner, and since the Crypt partner's story editor, whatever, right, makes everybody happy. And so I did not have the bona fides to be the showrunner of Tales from the Crypt, but because of circumstances, there I was. I had two jobs on Tales from the Crypt as I began. My first job was I was the person charged with making sure that the franchise got from the comic books to the small screen. Yeah. So every script had to travel through me. I was the last typist before it went out to department heads, to casting. So I was the keeper of the franchise flame. My other job was to write the Crypt Keeper segments. Just as the show never went through a development process, neither did the Crypt Keeper. Mm. The Crypt Keeper in the EC comic books is a old white guy with stringy hair.
Mm-hmm.
The executive producers wanted their own Crypt Keeper. One day at a storage facility, executive producer Joel Silver bumped into special effects maestro Kevin Yeager. Mm-hmm. And Joel saw all the things that Kevin had created, monsters. Eventually, yep, he created Chucky, among other things. Mm-hmm. Joel said, I want you to create a Crypt Keeper for me. And so Kevin Yeager created the Crypt Keeper.
Nice.
And then Kevin found John Kassir, who became the voice.
Yep.
Of the Crypt Keeper.
Who was also in First and Ten.
Yes, he had his connection in First and Ten
with as Zagreb. Yep.
Yes, yes, yes. And no one ever asked the question, okay, so who is he? Whoever wrote the scripts would throw a couple words at the Crypt Keeper, and that's basically what he would say. As I sat down to write the Crypt Keeper segments, I found my profound problem. I don't know how to write for a character who isn't. And so just to do my job, I needed to create a character to work with. I grew up loving old movies.
Yeah.
I love the Marx Brothers. And the Crypt Keeper became my little Groucho. And having to fill the Crypt Keeper with a personality and being a writer and therefore somewhat lazy, I reached for the closest personality at hand, which was me.
I literally
filled the Crypt Keeper with me. So though it looks like Kevin's puppet and it sounds like John's voice, every thought in the Crypt Keeper's head, every word that tumbled out of his mouth was me. I wrote every single word the Crypt Keeper said.
Nice.
And I can tell you, it was the most painful job I've ever had in my entire life. So writing and producing the Crypt was wonderful. Working on the Crypt Keeper segments was like passing organs through your nose. Really
makes you feel any better. I had a blast doing the Crypt Keeper voice for friends in college.
Oh, as a testament to John, was torture. The Crypt Keeper was actually six puppeteers working in concert. There was a right arm, a left arm. There were three working the animatronics of his face with various levers. And there was one responsible for the lateral and back and forth movement of the crypt keeper in wherever he was sitting or standing. I would write three or four to go because we produce them in a batch because it take a lot of choreography with the puppeteers, putting the crypt keeper set together. So we would do them in batches and I'd write them in batches. So I, like I said, it was pulling multiple organs through my nose. And then I would record what was called the beep track with John. And so we'd do a little rewriting with John sometimes. That was always fun. Then we'd be on set and the puppeteers would be in place. The director would yell action. The beep track would roll, beep, beep, beep. And John's voice would start and the crypt keeper would sit up. And suddenly this inanimate thing plus people became the crypt keeper. And though I know he ain't real, suddenly you forget that fact. The crypt keeper would say what I wrote for him. Finish, the director would yell cut, just ruining the whole
illusion.
The crypt keeper, it turned out, was the secret sauce. During the third season, our fortunes turned around because Gil and I reinvested in the franchise and all the episodes. We went after big stars, which was the original premise of the show. So we went back to the roots. But more than anything else, it turned out in the end was because we invested the Crypt Keeper with a personality, with an interior life. My question was, at the end of the working day, when he punches the time clock and goes back to his crypt, what does the crypt keeper do? What does he like to have for dinner? What does he like to watch on TV? Does he have hobbies? Does he have a gig on the side? Does he have friends? What do they talk about? And so my question was, who is he?
I just pictured him as like a Walmart greeter after hours, just like wearing the blue vest, walking around. Hello, kiddies.
He'd be wonderful. Walmart, get on the phone now. You could probably get him more expensive now than before. But a few years ago, TNT wanted to do a Thursday night horror wheel. And M. Night Shyamalan was going to be the executive producer. And one of the parts of the horror wheel was going to be a remake of Tales from the Crypt. And so he had optioned the comics. What he didn't realize was that the Crypt Keeper he had optioned was the old white guy with stringy hair. The Crypt Keeper, who appears in the TV series, is a completely separate piece of intellectual property owned by the Crypt Partners. Now, among the Crypt Partners, the guy who always walked point was Joel Silver.
Yeah.
Joel is an impresario in the old-fashioned sense. He's larger than life. He's made some of the great action franchises, you know,
absolutely,
Lethal Weapon movies, the Matrix movies. He also happens to be one of the biggest assholes who ever worked in Hollywood. I am not alone in saying that so many movies have Joel Silver characters. Joel Silver played the asshole in Roger Rabbit. In the beginning of the movie, Roger is in a scene. There's a director. The director is played by Joel Silver.
And he was right.
Joel Silver. It's hilarious. But he is a big asshole. At some point, everybody gets to the place where they think life is just too short. I will never work with you ever again. And all the Crypt Partners eventually got to that place. And Bill Gaines's estate got to that place. And they would never make a deal with Joel Silver ever again. Nothing that would ever put 2 cents in his pocket. And so therefore, Tales from the Crypt and the Crypt Keeper are divorced forever.
Wow.
Where will the children go for Christmas? We don't know. But the third season turned the fortunes of Tales from the Crypt around. And not only did we get that, the third season became ultimately 7 seasons. We suddenly became a long-running show. And Universal Pictures saw value in this, and they ordered 3 Crypt-branded feature films. All to be entirely different. Gil was supposed to direct the first, but the Crypt Partners, for a little while, we toyed with going after From Dusk Till Dawn. And that was almost the first Crypt feature.
But really?
Yeah, but we couldn't afford it. Quentin wanted too much money. He knew he had something great on his hands, and Robert Rodriguez got it, and they made a great movie. Another terrific script was called Demon Knight. It's a monster movie, and I didn't want to do a monster movie. We came out of comedy and loved doing Crypt, but if the feature films were going to open a door, we wanted to demonstrate to the town that we weren't one-trick ponies who could just do horror.
Right.
We saw this as an opportunity. We feared if we put our creative energies into making that our breakout movie. So we decided Gil would direct the second feature. And Ernest Dickerson, we hired Ernest Dickerson. He did a wonderful job. He's got an amazing cast. Billy Zane is a great villain.
He's terrific at it. Yeah.
We will come back to that. Jada and Bill Sadler, great heroes. The whole cast is wonderful in that movie. It's really, everyone is perfectly cast. We were developing a script for the second feature that would have been a total change of pace.
Yeah.
It was called, originally it was called Fat Tuesday. We evolved it into a thing called Dead Easy. It was a taut psychological thriller about a recovered memory. It took place in the swamps outside New Orleans.
Mm.
It had a wonderful franchise villain, this Harlequin character. We spent 18 months developing the script. The whole creative team was on board. Universal was on board spending their money. We spent 6 months in New Orleans prepping the movie. We hired a young unknown actress named Salma Hayek to play the female lead. 3 weeks before the start of principal photography in New Orleans, Universal called. They said, stop, don't spend another penny. Come home. You're not making that movie. So the whole creative team got on an airplane, went back to Los Angeles. They stuck another script under our noses and said, you're going to make this instead. Your release date hasn't changed. You still start shooting this in 3 weeks. Get going, boys. This script was called Bordello of Blood. Now, where did Bordello of Blood come from? At about this time, a new studio called DreamWorks had come into being. DreamWorks was Steven Spielberg leaving his deal, not the lot, at Universal and setting up as a studio.
Yeah.
And as a studio must, he began making talent deals with other talent. Universal was very much afraid of losing another big piece of talent, one of my executive producers, Bob Zemeckis. Spielberg was his mentor. Universal approached Bob. They said, Bob, we love you, Universal. What can we do to make you stay? Obviously, the deal worked. Bob stayed. I know one deal point. That's all I know about. Universal Pictures agreed to buy the first student script that Bob and Bob Gale, the Back to the Future guys, wrote while film students at USC for $500,000.
Oh.
It was called Bordello of Blood.
Really?
It was.
That's where it started.
It was a deal point, simply a way to get Bob Zemeckis to stay at Universal, just to put some money in his pocket and help Bob Gale too. It was just had nothing to do with anyone making a movie. But Universal sat there in the aftermath thinking, God, it's going to eat this $500,000. Wait a minute. Bob is about to make this other horror movie, this Dead Easy thing. We spent, what, $50,000 on the script? We'll take it out of their budget. Guys, you're making Bordello of Blood instead. Hey, it's got Bob Zemeckis and Bob Gale's name. Well, that's bigger than Alan Katz and Gil Katz and Gil Adler's name, isn't it? Guys, get to work. Mm-hmm. And so we had 3 weeks to rewrite the script, cast the script, design the script. Ludicrous. The whole creative team went from making a movie that we had spent 18 months devoting ourselves to. We all saw this as a way to prove to the town that we're not one-trick ponies. This was career path movie in our collective heads. We went from making that movie to making a student movie because of a deal. I can honestly tell you that nobody making Bordello of Blood wanted to make that movie. It was a job we didn't want to be doing. Literally nobody making that movie wanted to make it. Once you start down that road, do not be surprised when every day is stupider than the day before. And that is exactly what happened. Literally, making Tales from the Crypt, everyone who worked on that show would tell you as they look back on their careers that it was the most remarkable creative experience of our lives because of all the creative freedom we had. Working with HBO over the 70-some-odd episodes that I wrote and produced and oversaw, I got 3 notes from HBO.
Wow.
Total of 3 notes. Such creative freedom. And that's what our whole creative team had. You got to do good work. Tremendous trust and creative freedom. Bordello became the antithesis of every last bit of that because the integrity that we all had.
Okay.
No.
Turns out it was an excited yipe, not a hurt yipe. So.
Podcasting in life. How can crash into each other?
Finds a way to do that. So you're saying that everyone was doing this as a job.
And a job nobody wanted to do. Once you start making creative decisions for entirely cynical reasons, it suddenly became endemic. We were returning to Los Angeles, and the question was, where are we going to make this bordello of blood? Joel was perpetually at war with the union that represented our crew. And sometimes the union was up and sometimes Joel was up. A few months before, they had struck a TV movie that we were doing for Fox, a backdoor pilot called Weird World. And so Joel's attitude was, fuck me, no, fuck you. Rather than shoot the movie in Los Angeles, where the union would get a cut, we took the movie out of Los Angeles and ended up shooting it in Vancouver, not because there was a reason to shoot it in Vancouver, just to go to the IA. One of the problems with that was we're making a horror movie. When you make a horror movie, one of the things you need a shit ton of to shoot in is dark night. We were shooting in July. In Vancouver, when you're that far north, it doesn't get shootable dark until about midnight.
Oh, boy.
And the first light begins to appear in the sky around four-ish. So you get about
four. So you got four, a really tight window of shooting.
That's shooting days, 13 hours. You got 4 hours? Why would you do that to yourself? Yeah. That's stupid. But we weren't making decisions for creative decisions. We made a decision because to the IA. Now, there was another thing that also contributed to this. And we'll come to that momentarily. Joel also got it into his head that he was going to cast the three leads. Now, I'm hard at work trying to get this script rewritten because it's a student script and it reads like one.
Yeah.
But there are problems that are insurmountable. For instance, the hero of the movie is a small town detective. Now, ask yourself, how much business can a detective really do in a small town? Not enough to actually be a small town detective. That's the kind of character that film students would create. You know, people who've never lived in the world.
Right.
To recognize that's a non sequitur. That's just, that guy doesn't exist. How do you rewrite?
It's like a placeholder.
It's just a bunch of words that they type together. Now, if I got to go write a character to hire an actor, how am I going to justify this character? What's this character's backstory? So we all understand where they came from. This character cannot exist in any kind of practical world. So it's an impossibility to write characters with any depth whatsoever to help you hire the best possible actors. But still, we wanted to hire Danny Baldwin to be the detective. But Joel decided to hire Dennis Miller instead. And to this day, I couldn't tell you why Dennis Miller. Our audience was into special effects makeup and that kind of thing. Dennis Miller did a political show on HBO. That, our audience was not his audience.
They weren't connecting.
Nothing to do with each other. Why Dennis Miller? I couldn't tell you. Now, Dennis did not want to do the movie. And he said, all right, I'll do it for $1 million, figuring no one in their right mind would pay him $1 million to be in a movie when up to that point, I know because we looked it up, he'd gotten scale. Why would you give Dennis Miller, an actor that is not key to your audience, $1 million? We were a $13 million movie. We had a $12 million movie. We had $500,000 in the budget for that actor.
Yeah.
We went to Universal Pictures. We said, hey, can we get some help here? Can we get a little breakage? They said, we don't know why you're hiring him. No, you can't have any help. And so because Joel wouldn't change his mind, we took it out of our budget. We took it literally out of where all the money was in special effects makeup, the thing our audience came to see, to pay for an actor our audience didn't give a fuck about. What kind of decision-making is this? That was Dennis. We wanted an actress called Bridget Wilson to play the female lead. Joel wanted Erica Leniak. I know why Joel wanted it, but that was never going to happen. Erica was already in a long-term relationship. And just after we hired her, moments after she said yes to being in Bordello of Blood, she decided she didn't want to really be that kind of actress being in this kind of movie anymore.
Oh, really?
And so Gil, as a producer, but since he was directing the movie, especially, he likes to start production on a Thursday. That way you get 2 days of production. If there are any profound problems, you have a weekend to fix them before you start your first full week.
That's an interesting approach.
Oh, it's a great approach. It really is.
That's really smart. You know, that's a great way to do it.
Gil's a great producer. He really is. Gil was a great innovative producer. He really is. He was remarkable.
Like, that's pretty genius. Like, that's a great way to just kind of, it's like a soft opening kind of thing.
Indeed. So Erica was supposed to be on an airplane Saturday mm-hmm. to be in wardrobe Monday to work on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And on Saturday, her manager informs me that she's not getting on an airplane until we rewrite the script to her specifications because she doesn't want to be that kind of actress in this kind of movie anymore.
Oh, boy.
And so I'm having the most insane conversation. We finally find some middle ground and I agree to rewrite the script over the weekend to accommodate that so that she gets on an airplane Sunday, to be in wardrobe Monday. All right. Erica did not want to be there making our movie. She made it clear every single day that she did not want to be there doing the movie.
Which is not exactly a rah-rah kind of feeling for the rest of the crew, I'm sure.
Yeah, everyone kind of gets that. We wanted for the villain. Now, the villain of a horror movie is really important.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted Robin Givens to play the villain.
Oh, wow. She would have brought a real...
She'd have been terrific. Ooh. At the time that we were now going to be making Bordello of Blood in Vancouver, at the same time, our executive producers, Joel Silver and Richard Donner, were making another movie called Assassins mm-hmm. in Seattle.
Mm.
Assassins starred Antonio Banderas and Sylvester Stallone.
Yep.
Now, at the time, Stallone was engaged to a supermodel named Angie Everhart.
Mm-hmm.
And one day on the set, Stallone approached Joel. He said, "Hey, Joel, here gonna be making a movie in Vancouver. Why don't you put my girlfriend Angie in the movie? That way we can visit each other across the border." And rather than being a responsible executive producer and saying, "That's a great idea, Sly, but let me check with the guys to make sure it works for them," mm-hmm. he said, "That's a great idea, Sly."
And that's it.
In order to make one actor happy on one set, made a creative decision that was terrible in every way, shape, and form. Now, this is not casting aspersions on Angie. Angie was a supermodel. She wasn't trained as an actor. Now, the reason that Billy Zane is a wonderful villain in Demon Knight and Titanic is because Billy's an egomaniac. There's real darkness inside of Billy. And so when mm-hmm. Billy has to perform these parts, he's not acting. He's tapping mm-hmm. into a piece of himself and showing it to you honestly. And that's why he's really good. He's yeah. not acting. He's being.
He's tapping into something that's already there.
Indeed. Angie Everhart is a wonderful, lovely person. There is literally nothing villainous inside of her. In order to perform as a villain, the only thing Angie can do is act it. And she was not a trained actress or an actor. Even if Angie had been a trained actor and had the skill set to evoke this thing, it would still have been acting and not being. Angie never had a chance. It's not like we hired Angie because we saw her a performance on screen and we went, or Joel said, "I have an intuition about her."
Yeah.
That is not what happened. He was trying to make an actor happy. So this has nothing to do with Angie. Angie did the best she possibly could. But all she could do was act the part. The villain in this horror movie, it's not Angie's fault. It's our mm-hmm. fault for hiring a performer who did not have any of the necessities to pull off that part successfully. Mm-hmm. Gets away with it, but that shouldn't be the goal. Oh, we right. get away with this. That should not be the goal. We did not get away with Billy Zane in the first movie. Billy's brilliant. He's wonderful. He makes the movie.
Yeah.
That should be the goal. And that was unattainable because we made a casting decision for a completely inorganic reason.
Hmm.
That was that movie in every way, shape, and form. Now, it turned out that Stallone had an ulterior motive. He wanted to break up with Angie, and indeed he did break up with her 2/3 of the way through the shoot. One of the things he said to her was, "Yeah, I got you a movie, didn't I?" Initially, for the first couple of weeks, the cross-border visits happened, and Angie would fly from our set down to their set, and we would help coordinate it. Our production office was in constant touch with the Assassins production office. They had an ongoing relationship, those mm-hmm. two production offices.
Yeah.
And then one week, their production office calls our production office and says, "Hey, can you hold Angie for the weekend? Hold her homework?"
Right.
"What are you even talking about?" We said, "No." So this is the kind of stuff that we had to put up with.
How do you pivot to that?
You know, Bordello of Blood, I didn't want to be making that movie. I was not a good producer on that movie. I was a bad producer on that movie.
No. Am I going to look bad by saying that I actually enjoyed it?
Oh, no. Look, from the audience perspective, it's a competently banged together mediocre movie.
I told my friends that when they asked, I said, you have Dennis Miller and a minister running around a bordello spraying super soakers full of holy water while Ballroom Blitz is playing in the background. You should see this. that want to be like the selling point.
There might be a way to make a really interesting, fun movie about that, but we didn't have a chance to do that.
Yeah.
I don't know, if given time, not 3 weeks, to really think about how do we strip everything out except that core idea. Whorehouse of vampires. Okay. Yeah. In a mortuary. Great. Let's start there and build it with some really fun, well-constructed characters. But we never had a chance to do that. We had to take that student script and turn it into a movie under extreme time duress. Now, making the movie, everything that was wonderful about making Tales from the Crypt, the opposite was true. Bordello of Blood was my own personal Waterloo. Before too long, the entire Canadian crew hated every American. There, we did not represent ourselves well at all.
Yeah.
When we finally got to the wrap party, the producers did not throw the wrap party because we knew none of our Canadian crew would come to it. Our Canadian production manager, Colleen, through the wrap party, she invited the Americans. I was the only one who showed up. Mm-hmm. Everyone avoided me. That is how bad it got. When I went back to Vancouver as a co-executive producer on The Outer Limits a couple of years after that, Bordello of Blood still had a reputation. I had to convince some of the people who had worked on both, had heard stories, that I was not the flaming fucking asshole then. By the time Bordello was released, and our Halloween release date, Universal didn't care anymore, and they didn't release us for Halloween. They held us to the following
August.
We did not open.
You don't stand a chance when you're getting released in August.
By the time it was released, Gil and I, we had been best friends and partners for a decade. We were no longer speaking to each other. Gil went on to be a very successful, he was Warner Brothers producer of all their big tentpole movies. Mm-hmm. Superman.
Superman Returns. Yep. Valkyrie. Yep.
Constantine. Mm-hmm. So Gil produced all these huge, expensive movies because Warner Brothers trusted him with massive amounts of money. I went in the other direction. And I had a problem. You know, I saw Gil. I put Gil's name on every script that was written. But Gil didn't necessarily write anything in the scripts. I saw our writing and producing process as being part of the writing. For most writers, you don't produce your finished product. Someone else is going to do that for you. I got used to the fact that Gil and I are going to produce, and sometimes he even directed, that we had full control over our stuff. The writing process continues past the script. Having Gil's name on the scripts just, I don't know, made sense to me as you looked at the finished product.
Yeah.
But when Gil and I were no longer creative partners and I had to go out to the town and say, here's the part I wrote, it doesn't work that way. I suddenly had a whole career that I couldn't use anymore. And I was in a very terrible way. I did 2 seasons as a co-executive producer on The Outer Limits, which were wonderful. I really enjoyed those 2 years. But I began a descent into a 2 decades long depression and a writer's block. It's so hard to get on the showbiz mountain, the movie and TV mountain. Getting onto the mountain's hard. The hardest thing is staying on the mountain. That's what kills people. And then when you get cast off the mountain after you've been on the mountain and suddenly everyone you know is still on the mountain and you're not.
You have to work your way back up.
Well, I didn't have the wherewithal, the mental capacity, or the confidence, most importantly, to rebuild anything. So like I said, I went into this 2 decades long depression. The lack of confidence should have been a tell. And it turned out that I was keeping a secret from myself for 45 years. And 3 days before Christmas, 2016, I came within literal inches of killing myself. I knew I'd been heading in that direction. I was terribly afraid of medication. My dad was a surgeon. I grew up in the medical culture. And I knew that my GP, the last pharmaceutical rep who walked through his office, had said, hey, you got any depressed patients? Give them some of this. Maybe it'll help. You know, mood stabilizers are very a problematic kind of medication. Mm-hmm. We even under the best of circumstances. I did not want to be a lab experiment. No part of me was considered as I went, hey, try this. I had done some research. The darkness had a hold on me. I needed the darkness to lose its control, but I didn't want to lose my creative spark. It was the last thing I was holding on to. I'd found a medication that I thought would help. After the thing nearly happened, I drove right to my GP's office. I told them what I'd nearly done. They sent me right into an exam room, no waiting. My GP came in, the head GP came in, and I began to tell them my story. And they asked me three times if they thought perhaps I should be hospitalized. I think by the third time, they really meant it. But I assured them that, no, I want to try this. Here's this medication of research. Can you please prescribe this for me? They whipped out their smartphones. They looked it up and they went, okay. They wrote the script. I picked it up, went home, told my family what I was going to do. I took the first dose and then I got lucky. Within 36 hours at that minimal dose, I leveled. Literally felt the lamotrigine, which is what I take. It put the darkness into not a box, but a cage. The darkness is still there. I know it's there. And it can reach me through the bars, but it can't get me anymore. Mm. And suddenly, because all this self-directed rage, that should have been another tell. What's all this rage coming from? Well, now that the darkness was no longer consuming me, I could confront the fact that I've been keeping a secret for myself for 45 years. When I was 14 years old, the religious director at the synagogue where my family belonged sexually molested me twice.
Oh my God.
The first time is bad, but it's the second time that set the hook in me, because the second time only happened because I never said anything after the first time.
Oh boy.
And it's in the middle of the second time that it set the hook in my head, where I know I said to myself, you did this. This is your fault. You made this happen. And that then becomes a kind of template. And whenever anything bad happens, regardless of who's at fault, because it wasn't the 14-year-old me's fault that an adult was using me as a sex toy, but I took the blame for it. And that then became what I did the rest of my life. When you take blame for things that you shouldn't be taking the blame for, you're not solving anyone's problem.
All you're doing is adding on to your own.
You're not doing anything for anybody. There's no nobility in that. And when you begin to rage at yourself, well, if you can't tell your story to yourself, can you tell anyone else's story? Of course you can't. When I suddenly could tell my story to me with balls to the wall honesty, I will tell you that weekend when I suddenly came clean to myself, it was a Friday night, it was Saturday morning. I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I didn't want to wake my wife. I went into the bathroom. I lay on the bathroom floor and I wept for several hours for the 14-year-old me who didn't need to be responsible for this anymore. Once I could tell my story with honesty, I could tell anyone's story. Mm-hmm. And I went from being a pretty good writer into being a storyteller. That became my purpose. During the pandemic, a Tales from the Crypt fan group had formed. There were three dads from various parts of the country who were Crypt fans. And they created a podcast called Dads from the Crypt. They review episodes, all the episodes of Tales from the Crypt, and they give parenting advice. And
that's an interesting little combo there.
So Jason Stein, one of the dads, reached out to me. He said, we're going to be reviewing an episode you wrote. You want to sit in with us? And I went, yeah, that sounds like fun. And so I did. And it was great fun. A couple weeks later, Jason reached out again. He said, hey, we're going to be reviewing Bordello of Blood. You want to sit in again? And I said, Jason, the story of the making of Bordello of Blood is not a half-hour chat with you. It's a podcast unto itself. And that was the motivation for the first season of the How Not to Make a Movie podcast, which was subtitled The Making of Bordello of Blood. And in that first season, the first five episodes especially, it is the entire soup-to-nuts story of the making of Bordello of Blood. Now, in order to do it with the honesty with which I wanted to tell it, and there were three people I wanted to call out. Mm-hmm. I wanted to call out Dennis, we paid you $1 million. You could afford to be a nicer person. Fuck you, pal. You are an asshole. Unnecessarily so, Stallone, because he made us complicit. Angie's a lovely person. I resent what Stallone did to her, and I resent what he did to all of us by making us complicit in keeping. Mm-hmm. So I needed to call him out. The other person I needed to call out was me. I needed to say, yeah, I was a terrible producer on that movie. It was a terrible experience, but I could have changed that. I was the day-to-day producer. I had it in my power to do a better job, and I didn't. I really wanted to. I wanted to tell the story of making a movie that nobody wanted to make. In order to do it, I was going to have to reach out to Gil. I didn't want to talk to the actors because they really didn't know anything. It was everyone behind the scenes, the creative team, who had to go from making a movie we wanted to make to making a movie we didn't make. That's mostly who I wanted to tell the story, because that's what the story was about. I had to reach out to Gil, who I hadn't talked to in 25 years. And we started talking. I said, here's what I want to do. And I said, look, of course, we haven't talked about our breakup and all the implications of that. I said, I don't want to have any free conversations about it. I want to have those conversations live on mic as part of the podcast. He was a little worried about that. I said, you know, we won't release it until we've listened to it. But he went, okay. And we did it.
How was that?
Well, it was great because we were so honest about it. It was genuine. And we told the stories, and we told the story of the breakup from our hearts.
Sounds therapeutic.
Oh, as cathartic as can be. Entertainment Weekly called that first season the best film podcast of 2022, in part because of the honesty with which the story was told. Clark Collis, who wrote the piece, told me, he said he heard the podcast. He thought, is this bullshit? So he wanted to interview us just to see that we were real and genuine. That's what we actually sounded like. It wasn't a put on. That story that we told, and with the emotional honesty with which we told it. Well, I loved putting it together. I loved every bit of the process. I had a friend from school who approached me with a story. When he told me the outlines of the story, he wanted to do it as a TV series. I said, no, you don't. For all the reasons that I elaborated on before. But I'm going to tell you the subject matter. No, they would have fucked this so bad. My friend, let's call him Hal, worked his way through medical school in the mid-1990s as an anonymous sperm donor. Jump forward 27 years, Hal was a successful radiologist. He joined 23andMe, curious about his health genes. Never occurred to him the ramifications of adding his DNA to a growing DNA database. That's what 23andMe and Ancestry are. He lost his donor anonymity. Suddenly, total strangers found daddy, except six of them had no idea their actual biological father was Hal, a sperm donor. These were 25, 26, 27-year-old people who were suddenly bumping into the fact that they didn't know who they were. They thought, I come from you and I come from you. Well, not so quick, pal. You actually come from someplace else entirely. Wow. One of the daughters brought a thing called genetic sexual attraction to the table. Hal had been married to a woman who had brought a child from a previous marriage to the relationship, and he raised that son as his own, adopted him later as an adult, but he had never raised any of his own biological children. Suddenly, knowing that there were these seven biological children, he wasn't going to be their father. They'd had fathers, but he could be fatherly towards them, and he was very open to having as much of a family-like relationship with them as they wanted. He had money, and so he was willing to cut them in on the inheritance because they were blood. So he was quite fully committed in multiple genuine ways to being family with them. But when this one daughter brought genetic sexual attraction to it, and she had read an article in Cosmopolitan about how sometimes when people who are genetically related aren't raised together, there can be a sexual spark between them. The woman who coined the term, Barbara Gagner, gave up a son for adoption when she was 16. She met him 25 years later. He's a 25-year-old adult now.
Oh, no.
And she fell head over heels in love with him. And he fell in love with her. She was quite ready to have sex with him. He wasn't quite there. But she described it as the most intense feeling she'd ever had. She was not his mother. She didn't mother him in any way, shape, or form. She said that And a lot of the adoption community has known about this for a long, long time. These are siblings who are genetically related, not raised together. They meet as adults, and they describe meeting someone who they feel like they've known their whole life, who completes their sentences, laughs at the exact same things they do. They have this connection that they've never had with anybody else. Well, yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, you do. And so genetic sexual attraction was a hand grenade thrown into the tent, and it destroyed any possibilities whatsoever, because the relationship between the donor conceived siblings, they sometimes refer to each other as diblings. The relationship between the donor conceived siblings is very intense. These are people who suddenly discover, oh, I've got a half brother, I've got a half sister. And these are very intense connections.
Yeah.
Much more intense than the connection to the donor parent.
Hmm.
And so this daughter who brought genetic sexual attraction to the table was able to steer it. And this became the thing that stood between Hal and his donor conceived children because of an accusation, very problematic. Now, when Hal told me this story, I said, first of all, this became my first story podcast, The Donor, a DNA horror story. It's 7 episodes. I realized that I had become the thing I always wanted to be when I grew up, which is a podcaster. I loved telling Hal's story in this medium because I could tell it honestly. To me, this was a great story, very easy to screw up.
Yeah.
It's a problematic story, but I wanted to tell it. Hal would have wanted to tell his story anonymously. That's why we call him Hal. If he tries to tell his story himself, he's already an unreliable narrator, and he's going to change other names too. You're completely unreliable. Mm-hmm. But I could tell Hal's story because I'm an outsider. And if I maintain his anonymity, I don't lose my reliability as a narrator. I become the referee.
Mm.
And so knowing this, and again, having worked in movies and TV, I bring a very cinematic sensibility to my storytelling. And so there are, yes, there's conversation where Hal is talking. And because I was telling Hal's story, you needed to hear my voice too, because I am the audience's perspective. Podcasting also gave me the chance, let's talk about the donor-conceived world.
Yeah.
Let's talk about who these people are. Let's talk about this. I could shoot off to the side and do a deep dive and be another kind of storyteller while telling the story to really present the fullest possible story of Hal and his circumstances so that... It's called a DNA horror story because I think there are multiple monsters, but there's one particular monster at the heart of it. That was part of the appeal. While I was putting that together, doing research about the donor-conceived community, one of the people who agreed to give me background was a woman named Donna Hall, who learned at 40 that she was donor-conceived, blew her mind. When Donna began to tell me her story, I said, Donna, you're a podcast unto yourself. She said, yeah, I know, I've been trying. Donna has an amazing story, but a great story needs to be told the right way to really be amazing. Donna grew up in the 80s and 90s in a lower tier crime family outside of Philadelphia. The Halls weren't the Corleones from the Godfather movies, but they made national headlines just the same. Donna's mom, Phyllis, may be the worst mom ever. She spent 6 months in prison for child endangerment. Donna's stepdad, John Hall, a true criminal mastermind, he was the Philadelphia Police Department's favorite snitch. He put more than 24 people behind bars on bullshit confessions that John Hall concocted to mediate his own considerable legal jeopardy. Among the people that John Hall put in prison was his own stepson, Herb Hack, who spent 18 months awaiting trial for a murder he did not commit. John Hall also put a man named Walter Ogrod on death row in Pennsylvania for 24 years. At the time before he was on death row, 29 years total in prison for a murder Walter did not commit. When Pennsylvania finally let Walter out, they gave him $9.1 million because of their fuck up.
Yeah.
A guy, the last person who was serving a sentence because of John Hall, who died 20 years ago, named David Dixon, was just released from Pennsylvania. He was serving a life sentence based on a bullshit John Hall confession. All right. Donna describes in her podcast what it was like growing up in this crime family where literally every single day, one or more of the adults was doing something criminal, whether it was big or just, you know, sexual assault.
Right.
An amazing story. What makes it work is that Donna's a great storyteller. She's vivacious, not an ounce of self-pity. Her story isn't just a true crime like you've never heard it before. It's so granular. It's also her journey towards safety and empowerment.
Mm.
How can I not want to tell this story? While I was doing Donna's podcast, The Hall Closet, at the hallclosetpodcast.com, I realized this is all I want to do. I want to tell stories via podcasting. And I began to look for all kinds of other stories and people's stories that I could tell. We're now preparing a second season of Hall Closet. The first episode, the first season was 8 episodes. Second season is now in the works. I began just doing all that, doing podcasts. Now, here's the thing about podcasting as a way to tell stories.
Right.
I still think every one of these would make a great TV series or movie. In the old days, I would have had to write that script, go through all that process. The whole point of selling a thing is to convey what the IP is from my head into the executive's head. So the executive can go to their boss and go, okay, here's what the idea is. Here's the concept. Here's the IP. That's the whole point of the song and dance.
Yeah.
But rather than go to them, cap in hand, the dog and pony show going, please understand what my IP is, I put the IP into the podcast. It's there on the table where everyone can see it, where there's an audience. You're listening to advertisers already paying money to that audience. Instead of me going to sell it to them, these are risk-averse executives. Instead of taking a chance, I'm saying, here, this is the IP. And so they're going to come to buy it. And they're going to say to me, hey, you know, that Hall Closet would make a great TV series. I'm going to go, yeah, hey, you know, you're right. And they're going to say, well, here's a check. And I'm going to go, well, that's nice, but you're going to have to add some zeros and move the decimal point over because you have competition. I truly believe that podcasting, because of its nature, we can produce the whole thing, soup to nuts, one person, really, for a nominal cost. And make it sound like you're a whole production company. So at a nominal production cost, I can create the whole thing. I own the whole thing. This is, I think, a legitimate way for the creatives to flip the power dynamic from the money to the creatives where it belongs. The first thing I'd have to do if I went to pitch it to them is I'd have to sell it 100%. Even if they went to produce it, they would then own it. They could rewrite it to their heart's content. And I never get to make it the way I want to.
Because they own it.
Because I've done it as a podcast, I told the story exactly the way I wanted to. And hey, if I got an audience and if I got paid advertising dollars, I got paid for it too. The sale to the movie and TV people, that's icing. Do I care about what it is? Yeah, I suppose. But do I want to show up on their set, be part of their development process? Fuck no. I want to take my money and go create other podcasts, do something sane and civilized with it. When you get into the production process, into the craftspeople, yeah, we're cool. But that's a long time coming. By then, I'll have enjoyed my money many times over while other people are suffering the travails of the damned. I have discovered I love podcasting. I wake up now every day filled with purpose. My little company, Costard and Touchstone, in my very brief acting career, I appeared in 2 Shakespeare productions. I played the part of Costard in a production of Love's Labour's Lost, and I played the part of Touchstone in a production of As You Like It. Both characters are wise fools, speak truth to power. That's what my little podcasting company does. We make great podcasts and speak truth to power. We're wise fools speaking truth to power. That's a very important part of the stories I want to tell. Our goal is to make the world a better place through storytelling. That is my purpose in life. I wake up every day. I am overscheduled to the hilt. The thing I love about being in TV is that you got a script that you're writing, a script that you're prepping for production, a script that's in production, a script that you're editing, a script that you're posting after the edit. You're doing the music and all that stuff. You got 8 different things happening at all times and constant deadline pressure with each. Plus, you got to live your life. I love that. Nice. I, to a degree, I've recreated and got all these podcasts. I just released my latest podcast on Friday, and that'll be every week. It's called Just the Photographer. And I'm doing it with a Pulitzer Prize winning photojournalist named David Swanson.
Nice.
For 40 years, David has been to battlefields, war zones from Bosnia to Afghanistan to Iraq to Los Angeles just now, to natural disasters, Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, to the earthquake in Haiti in 2010.
Yep.
He's been to red carpet events like the Oscars. And his pictures can tell you a thousand words of what it looked like standing where he stood, but they cannot tell you what it felt like standing there. And that's what the podcast is all about, the stuff that his pictures can't tell you.
Gotcha.
And that's Just the Photographer with David Swanson, which you can find anywhere you listen to podcasts. I'm really happy David snuck it to a bunch of journalists, which was terrifying. And the response was uniformly, wow, bravo, yeah. David. So if the journalists said we're telling the story the right way, it's really compelling. It's like a parent, you know, you're proud of all your babies. I'm proud of all my babies. I'm very proud of this one. New episodes every Friday, Just the Photographer with David Swanson. There's another one that's releasing new episodes right now called Sage Wellness Within, which is about Chinese medicine with Dr. Andrea Thorpe. That's telling the story of Chinese medicine. Mm-hmm. What Andrea does that's remarkable, she takes this 5,000-year-old observation and makes it very understandable to today's generation, to the uninitiated as to how exactly this thing works and why it works, because it does work. And for 5,000, it wouldn't still be here after 5,000 years if there wasn't a tremendous amount of validity in its practice. Dr. Andrea Thorpe explains eloquently that helps too. I have found my purpose in life. It's podcasting. It's storytelling.
That's wonderful. Talk about an epic journey to really start off this season like that. Having gone through all of this, having bottomed out and then finding a way back up, but finding it back up on your own terms. This is a medium that you yourself want to do. You're not doing it because some other person is saying that they believe that you should do this instead. You are setting your own path. You are making your own destiny. And there's no greater Excelsior journey than that. Because
what's not to love about that?
Exactly. And that's why I hope that every one of you who has been listening has taken at least half as much as what I have. Because now I'm anxious to finish up this next project so I can move on to the next thing and get stuff going. And, you know, who knows what the future, I already know what the future of this show is. It's going to keep going.
Two words that are very important to me.
Go do. By all means.
It's that simple.
Go do. That is the title of season 11 premiere. Like that is, I can't think of anything better than that, because that's basically what everything that you have been doing just, you know, crunches into just two simple words, go do. And I mean, we have so much going on that we never even got to touch on your time working on Freddy's Nightmares, which I was really looking forward to. Have you on again.
This can be part one of however many parts. Hey, until the story is told to your satisfaction, my friend.
The story never ends. That's the way I see it. Just like that journey, all it does is just lead to, it's what was the line from 1987's Masters of the Universe? Live the journey, for every destination is but a doorway to another.
Yeah. Indeed.
That's from a canon film. You can find insight in every place you can. So,
indeed.
Oh, man. Alan, I cannot thank you enough for being such an amazing guest and telling such an epic story. I hope that all of you who have been listening can take what he has given you and go do. Get those stories out there. Finish that script. Finish that book. Go through the edits. Get that film up and running. Get the podcast up and running. Nothing can stop you from starting your own podcast. Get your microphone. Get your equipment and do it.
And then find your audience.
Yes.
And think about your audience. Where are they? There are so many ways. These are just problems waiting to be solved. Solve the problem.
And just as I've said many times in these crazy times, we need your thoughts, we need your vision, we need your ideas, we need your stories now more than ever. So for Alan Katz, this is George Soroy saying to all of you, ever upward, and I will see you next week.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Excelsior Journeys. I hope it was both inspiring and entertaining. Special thanks to Zach Comtois for providing new music for the intro and outro. Please take a moment to leave a rate and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy the show, please share it with your friends and subscribe to your platform of choice by going to hesgotit.com/podcasts. While there, you can also fill out the application to be a guest, inquire about sponsorship opportunities, and click on the Buy Me a Coffee link if you wish to give your support to the show. All interaction is very much appreciated. If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for the show, please direct it to george@hesgotit.com.